Hi, everybody. That's what it feels like. So tonight, we're going to have a discussion about anger. And anger not just individually, but societal anger. And can anger ever be skillful? How can it be skillful? What was the Buddha's advice on anger as it arises? Does it arise in everybody? Are some of you just no anger at all? Fortunate people. So I'm going to start with a story that the Buddha told. It's been told in various ways. Can everybody hear me? Okay?
No.
All right. It's been told in various ways. Here's a version I heard. And it starts with Sakka, who is king of the Devas. And the Devas are kind of like Buddhist angels, except they're in a very happy place, and they're very happy beings, and everything is lovely, and Sakka is their king. And he decided to leave that particular place for a little bit, and his sitting place was empty, and it was this beautiful kind of throne thing with embroidered pillows, gorgeous. And so the other Devas are just wandering around it when all of a sudden an anger-eating demon appears. And he goes over to the seat where Sakka always sits, and he sits on it himself. Now, in some versions of the story, this anger-eating demon is disgusting. He's got a foul odor. He's dripping all kinds of mucus as he's going up to the throne and leaving it on these embroidered pillows. Pretty revolting. And he's revolting looking himself. So he's sitting there and the other Devas are going, what is going on? Who is this guy? He's revolting and he's smelly and he shouldn't be sitting on Sakka's throne. So they start yelling at him. They start yelling at him and say, get out of here. Who are you anyway? Leave. And you smell bad. Everything's wrong with this situation. And what happens as they're doing this? He gets bigger and bigger. He's an anger-eating demon. He thrives on anger, and he becomes more foul-looking and grosser and dripping more of this mucus. They can't hardly stand it. The Devas don't know what to do. And then Sakka, the king of the Devas, appears. And he goes up to the anger-eating demon, and he says, well, how nice of you to visit. I really am glad to see you. Would you like a cup of tea? Or perhaps something to eat? And the anger-eating demon is looking at him, and he starts shrinking and getting smaller. And the more Sakka speaks kindly to him and offers him hospitality, the smaller and smaller the anger-eating demon gets, until finally he knows he has to leave or he'll disappear completely. He can't stay in that place with Sakka, king of the Devas. So he leaves. So keeping that story in mind, I'm just going to throw out this question. Is anger ever an appropriate response? Anybody? Is anger ever an appropriate response? Also keep in mind, everybody knows what metta is. Anger is the far enemy of metta. It's the opposite. Yeah.
I apologize for coming in a little late, so you may have already, based on what you already said, this may be obviously not true, but I'm wondering, is anger a response? Because it's striking me that it's an emotion. Mm-hmm. And then, okay, so we can have an emotion, and then there's what we say and what we do, which is, to me, that's a response. An emotion is not a response. I mean, either the reaction or the response can vary depending on what the emotion is, maybe. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I see exactly what you're saying, and actually, I think you're right. I think you're exactly right. Aversion is one of the three poisons that the Buddha talked about that causes us suffering. And anger is on that continuum. You know, aversion can be just a mild displeasure. I don't like it this way. Or it can go all the way up to aggression. And it's an emotion until the point you get to physical aggression. And then you are causing harm not just to yourself, but to others as well. And so, is it ever an appropriate response then? Yeah, Mom?
You mean expressed or unexpressed?
I don't know. Is it ever an appropriate response?
I'm thinking of people that hold anger inside and never express it. We've all heard about it. You know people like that have heard about it. And it's a way also eventually to get make yourself very, very ill.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe die or it seems to me that anger is anger, whether you express it outwardly or not.
Well, we're going to go into skillful ways of dealing with anger, but in Buddhist practice, the Buddha never condoned aggression. Never. But anger actually did happen, and my feeling is there are some appropriate places for it, done skillfully, without the ego being involved, and I think that possibly is the practice. So, as I just said, aggression is something the Buddha did not condone. This practice doesn't condone, and there's instances in the Pali Canon where the Buddha actually took a stand against aggression that was taking place, and one of the best known was a war that was about to take place between the Sakyas and the Koliyas, who were two tribes in northern India, and the Rohini River divided their territories, and they each wanted more of the river for themselves, and they were about to go to war on it. And the Buddha stepped in, and paraphrasing, he said, "You would, for a trickle of water, endure thousands of dead bodies." And they thought about it, and he intervened, and the war didn't take place. And this practice itself in India at the time went completely against the social norms. The caste system was in play. There were four castes, and then there was the people who we would now call the Dalits, the untouchables, who didn't even have a name. They just did the absolute most menial chores. And the Buddha said all of them can join the Sangha. He thought the way they were treated was wrong. Anybody can become enlightened. Anybody can practice. Women were treated as objects as well, had no rights, and they were allowed to join the Sangha. So this was a complete upheaval of society at the time, which caused a lot of enemies and a lot of people not appreciating what he did. And then I think one of the best examples of somebody saying no to anger, no to aggression against other beings is King Ashoka. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of King Ashoka? And King Ashoka came into power about 250 years after the Buddha died. And he was a great field commander. He wanted to conquer all of India, all of the area up to Afghanistan. And after this one battle, I think it was the Battle of Kalinga, he looked out over this battlefield where there was hundreds of thousands of dead beings. People, animals, and he woke up and he said, "This is wrong. This kind of aggression is wrong." And he created a society that, as far as I can tell, was one of the greatest societies ever to be created. I wish we could emulate it here, where everybody was cared for. There were hospitals for everybody. He planted herbs and medicinal herbs along all the roadways, so people, if they got sick, would have that available to them to them. He was the first person to have an Endangered Species Act. He said there were some species who should not be killed. Actually, he encouraged no killing of any animals, encouraged vegetarianism, but there were some that he absolutely said could not be killed. He was much kinder to prisoners than anybody else, gave them time off to visit their families. So he was an enlightened ruler who saw how much aggression caused problems in the world. And then since that time, we've got a host of examples of people who got angry, didn't like the way society was going, and decided to say no, decided to change it. So before we can even look at that, we have to, as Miles said, look at this whole emotion on an individual basis and when it occurs in us and what happens and what do we do with it. And can it ever be used skillfully? You know, going into prison, and those of you who go into prison see this, so many young men are in prison because they were angry, because their egos were not respected, and they acted out aggressively. They didn't feel they were seen, and so they acted out aggressively. And what happens? They not only cause suffering for others, they cause immense suffering for themselves as well. And this is what happens when aggression is serving the ego on an individual basis. When we get to that point, that's what aggression is. It is defending the ego itself. So what do we do about it? Somebody, Miles was saying, maybe we express it. Well, the Buddha said no. There's actually two ways that most people think anger should be expressed, and the Buddha said no to it. One is expressing it out loud. Anybody remember pillow therapy? I remember it as when you took a pillow and you hit everybody in sight and walls and everything else until you felt the anger was gone. That was the theory of pillow therapy. This is many years ago. And then the other way of dealing with anger was to suppress it. You know, nope, it's not there. I'm not going there. And the Buddha said both of these are the wrong ways of handling anger. By expressing it through pillow therapy, guess what? You just get good at anger. You get really, really good at being angry. And you will use that all the time, not to the benefit of yourself or others. If you suppress it, well, you know what happens with suppressed anger. It comes up in various other ways, and you end up with all kinds of problems and seeing all kinds of therapists. And so that's not a skillful way of handling it either. So we have to use skillful means when dealing with anger. And skillful means using wisdom and compassion in looking at anger as it occurs. And the very first thing we can do, and those of you who have taken the beginning meditation course that Rich and Dennis teach, is the pause, Kanti, patience. Actually, when anger comes up, stopping. Just stopping. That's a huge thing to do, to not just elevate it and let it continue, but to actually stop and feel it. And then you can become mindful of it. How does it feel in the body? What's happening in the mind? What's taking place? And as you slow that process down, you can start responding to it instead of reacting to it. I've told the story, and I'll tell it again, about one inmate who did this. He had been picked on in the yard continually. He was really getting tired of it. And the guys in the yard who were picking on him knew if they said certain things to him, he'll respond a certain way and get really angry. And they all laughed, and this is really fun to do this. This was entertainment to them. And we had had a class, and he decided to try practicing mindfulness when this took place. So he went out in the yard. They started in again, calling the usual names, just waiting for him to explode and tell him what he would do to him next time he sees them and blah, blah, blah. And he said instead he just paused. He felt what it was like to be angry, and he started getting interested in the way his heart was beating, how he felt his face getting red. He was really paying attention. And as he's doing this, the anger is subsiding. And then he thought, and this I think is one of the best things you can do when anger is arising, is who is suffering right now? And in his case, who was suffering right then? He was. That's right. The people who are provoking him, they're just waiting for the response. They're enjoying themselves. And if he gives in, they got everything they wanted, and it's just going to escalate. And he thought that. He said, who is suffering here? He was. And he said, it took everything, but he turned around and walked away. He said, I wasn't going to give him any more entertainment. And the taunting stopped. The entertainment was gone. He took control of the situation. The other thing about anger is, anybody ever notice it's addicting? Ever get angry at somebody and you actually enjoy it? And if you're really angry, you might even start making up stories about that person to escalate the anger if there's not enough coming up. I know what they'll do in this situation. Or I know what will happen then. Oh, man, that just makes me mad when I think about what they would do when this takes place. We've all done it. We've all done it. It's an addicting emotion. We have control, we feel. But it's going to backfire on us if we stick to that. I had, I was telling my first Brahma Vihara class, so forgive me for telling the same story again, but I have a neighbor who I've never met up till last week. Know nothing about her. She lives in a rental a couple doors down. And she came over, and I've never spoken about her to anyone because I don't know her. I've never seen her. I don't know who she is. But she came to my house banging on the door. And I opened it, and there was this young woman standing there, and she started, and I'm not going to go into what she started, but she just started screaming at me how I was a cyber bully, and I was talking about her to the neighbors, and now she's going to be hated in the neighborhood. And I'm sitting there and going, first of all, what am I, in an alternative universe? I don't know even, I said, I don't even know who you are. What are you talking about? And I realized she's probably been drinking and maybe has some mental problems. And then I started monitoring my response, and I realized there was no anger. I thought, this practice really works. There was no anger. But what there was on that continuum I was talking about, there was concern. There was concern for her and her mental state, and there was concern for me and my welfare. That's all that was there. So I really wanted her out of my vestibule, and I said, you know, I think you've said enough. I think you need to go home. Start shutting the door. She pushed it open again. Don't you slam the door in my face. I'll get the cops on you. Fortunately, my son is visiting right now. My son is 6'4" and 250 pounds, and he stood up and said, I think you need to go home now. And she said, okay. So that took care of it. But it was interesting monitoring the situation and having practiced enough. And, you know, sometimes you wonder, is this practice working or not? In situations like that, you realize, boy, it really is. Because, it, you know, 15 years ago, I don't even want to think of what I might have done and how that might have escalated into something pretty horrible. So the antidote for anger is what? Come on.
Metta.
That's right. That's right. Metta is the antidote. Anger is the far enemy. Metta is boundless friendliness. Anger is the far enemy. The near enemy is those in the Brahmavihara class.
What I found useful is not thinking of anger as a real emotion as other emotions are, that it's a secondary emotion, and everything else is primary emotions. And when we do reflect on anger, we discover very often something else came first.
Absolutely.
I stub my toe, then I curse. And that's one of the reasons why just letting that go doesn't work, because you never know, get back to the pain.
That's right.
Or suffering that's coming first.
Absolutely.
And I don't know if that little monster guy, you know, that's where you want to invite him in and have the conversation, because until you get to the pain and the hurt, it's very challenging.
You know, you're absolutely right. And one technique that a very well-known teacher, Ajahn Amaro, who's now abbot at Amaravati in England, he advises exactly that. He says trace it back. As part of your meditation, when anger comes up, see if you can trace it back. And just doing that, seeing the origination of it, will cause it to dissipate. As you see, it's just another phenomena rolling along. So, yeah, excellent advice. Near enemy, yes.
Pity?
No, that is the near enemy to compassion.
So
but you're getting close.
I didn't understand the question.
It's supposed to be the near enemy of metta, you're asking?
Yes, something that...
I don't like it, but aversion.
No, that's a far enemy or anger. Near enemy, what is like boundless friendliness, but there's a lot of selfing going on with it. You know, it is attachment. It could be passionate love. It could be attachment. But it has to do with me. It's not a boundless friendliness. It's a, what am I going to get out of this situation if I care for you? Which is why in metta, when we work on the categories as we start working further and further out, we never start with a partner. Because there's always that contract with it. I'll love you, but you've got to love me. And with boundless friendliness, the ultimate goal is I will care for you, I'll be concerned about you, but I don't expect anything in return. I just know it opens my heart and it makes me happy. So, so attachment, passionate love, near enemy to metta. I was telling the Brahmavihara class for years I felt like a metta failure, a complete, absolute metta failure. Metta, when I first started practicing, was defined as loving kindness. And I could certainly find loving kindness to those who I cared about, and sometimes even conjure it up for a neutral person, but never a difficult person. I never got that far, and I got very, very frustrated with metta. I thought I was the only one. It was like my deep, dark secret. Metta frustrates me. I'm a metta failure. And then I spoke to a friend of mine, and I was telling him about this, and he said, well, you're not the only one. My teacher, and I'm not going to name this person because you don't know, said he ran out of a metta retreat because he was so angry. He was so frustrated with having to feel this depth of loving kindness that never, ever happened, that he just wanted to leave. And that's pretty much how I felt. Up to about 6 or 7 years ago, and I started reading, and actually have done 2 retreats with a man named Bhikkhu Anālayo. And Bhikkhu Anālayo, his specialty is, first of all, he's a monk, about 50 years old. He is an adept meditation practitioner. He's just very inspiring, but he's also quite a scholar. His teacher was Bhikkhu Bodhi, and Bhikkhu Bodhi said it's very satisfactory when your student surpasses you in his scholastic ability, which shows Bhikkhu Bodhi's ego as well and how limited it is to be so happy for his student. Anālayo doesn't just go back to the original teachings. He goes even further back because he said the original teachings in the Pali Canon have all been monkeyed around with. One teacher says by cranky monks, you know, wanted to change things around. So what he does, he goes back and he will look at the original teachings in the Pali. He has taught himself Chinese, so he goes to the Chinese agamas and sees if they're there. And he taught himself Tibetan, so he will sometimes check on a third source. And if they're in all three places, he figures they're pretty original. And they haven't been distorted very much. But if, especially Chinese agamas and the Pali Canon, if one of them is missing, then he is suspect. I could go on and how he's changed my way of thinking, but he also had a problem with metta and the way it was defined. I was happy to read and and hear when I went to one of his retreats. And so I'm going to read this quote from his book, which is Compassion and Emptiness in Early Buddhist Meditation. In the early discourses, metta does not seem to convey the feeling of love a mother has for her child, contrary to the position, take, for example, in the Visuddhimagga. The Visuddhimagga was compiled by a man named Buddhaghosa, who compartmentalized everything. This is where we, those of you who know metta practice, have the categories as we gradually move out into the world. The Buddha never taught that. Such love or affection would find its expression in the Pali discourses instead in terms like apeka, pema, or piya. A stanza in the Metta Sutta, however, could easily give the impression that metta stands for a mother's love. Here is my translation, and he also retranslates everything, the stanza in question. Just as a mother who has an only son would protect her only son with her life, so one should cultivate a boundless mind towards all living beings. That's a little bit different than you've got to love everybody as a mother does for her child. He goes on, the stanza describes the protection a mother would be willing to give to her only son to the extent of even being willing to risk her life. Her love of her son is not the theme here. The point is protection. The point is protection. The providing and receiving of protection is in fact a recurrent aspect in the conception of metta in the earliest discourses. The simile in the Metta Sutta encourages the cultivation of an attitude of protection towards others, not the cultivation of a form of love towards others that models itself on a mother's feelings for her child. In contrast to the bounded love of a mother for her child, which easily comes with an admixture of attachment, metta should be boundless and free from attachment. So, for me, that was a relief, because I can, and I think I most of the time, do not wish anybody harm. I don't want to see even people I completely disagree with harmed. I want people to be safe. I might not love them, but I want them protected, and I want them to be safe, and I wish them well. And for some people, that's the best I can do. And according to Bhikkhu Anālayo, that's fine. That's good. So I really appreciate it. I'm doing another retreat with him in April, and I'm really looking forward to it. So a question, one that I've found interesting to investigate. Let's take a fully enlightened person. Does a fully enlightened person ever get angry? Anybody have any ideas?
I've never met one.
Theoretically, would you think a fully enlightened person would get angry?
He's still on the earth, so still human.
Still human? Okay. Yeah.
Kind of along those lines, was Jesus angry when he cleared the temple?
Mm-hmm.
because I'm not, can, from the outside, can confrontation and injustice look like anger?
Exactly.
In terms of that energy. And I don't want to suppressing our energy related to justice, thinking that we're not being angry. And I don't know if Buddha had any examples, but certainly that's one with Jesus. And I'm not sure if he didn't know Buddha yet, but I consider him enlightened.
Yeah, I think Jesus was most likely an enlightened person, and he did get angry. For the longest time, I thought that a fully enlightened person would have this blissful, serene personality, like the statues of the Buddha, just sitting there placidly looking, you know, just peaceful. Nothing upset them. I'm thinking, I'm never meeting an enlightened person. I'm certainly never going to be there, because that's not going to happen. You know, it's just not going to happen. And I was reading some of Ajahn Amaro's writings, and he has a different take on it, which I really appreciate. We all have different personalities, and some of us are going to exhibit anger more easily than others, and some people are not going to exhibit anger. I'm going to go in more into this in a bit, but he talks about a monk in China called Xu Yun. Anybody ever hear of Xu Yun? He was a monk in the 1930s and 40s in China, and he was so revered because of his kind, compassionate attitude and his wisdom that the five major Buddhist sects in China all asked him to be their teacher, the main teacher. They all came together under him. He was quite remarkable. And when the communist government came into power and they were outlawing Buddhist practice, they, of course, went to him immediately and said, stop teaching. And he said no, so they took him away and tortured him within an inch of his life. And when they let him go, it took a couple years for him to get his health back, and then he started teaching again. And they came and took him away again and tortured him within an inch of his life, and he went back and started teaching again. He ended up living to 105 years old. He died in the 1950s, I believe. And before he died, he was asked by one of his students, you have gone through so much. Your body has taken so much. Your mind has taken so much. And yet you've lived to 105 years old. How do you even begin to explain that? And he said, I willed myself to live because I didn't want the people who tortured me to die with that bad karma. I wanted to live long enough for them to atone. Wow. You know, that just, okay, that's an enlightened being, no doubt about it. His concern was just automatically for others, a bodhisattva, completely in the making. And then Ajahn Amaro then says, but on the other hand, you have someone like a very well-known teacher, Mahabua. And Mahabua was a curmudgeon. He was a trained pugilist before he became a monk. He apparently had a very short temper, yelled at people. That was his way of teaching them, you know, tell them they were fools. And by the way, the Buddha actually called a couple people fools as well. And he was brought to the United Kingdom to teach, but he caused such a ruckus because of his behavior and because he was so mad at everybody that they actually had to have somebody talk to him about his rough language. And what did he say? He said, I'm so sorry. I'm really sorry. I was born with this personality and I can't help myself. But please accept my apologies, and I meant no harm to anybody. And so Ajahn Amaro says there's a difference between personality traits and purity of the heart. So another example of this, I'll come back to it if I have time, but the Buddha talked about 6 personality traits. We all have personality traits. And some of us get more angry than others. The Buddha talks about, and I'm going to go into this, Rich and Dennis and I might be doing, we were discussing possibly doing a course on this. This is on social and communal harmony. And a lot of good stuff in here about what the Buddha said about creating a just society and being able to interact with each other. I've been reading it voraciously and really enjoy it. But he talks about, you know, people who have anger issues, who tend to get angry. He said there are 3 types. And he said, and what kind of, there are 3 types of people who get angry. And one of them is a person is like a line etched in the stone. Here some person often gets angry, and his anger persists for a long time, just as a line etched in the stone. And what kind of person is like a line etched in the ground? Here some person often gets angry, but his anger does not persist for a long time, just as a line etched in the ground. And what kind of person is like a line etched in water? Here some person, even when spoken to roughly and harshly in disagreeable ways, remains on friendly terms with his antagonist, mingles with him, and greets him. So Xu Yun was one of those people. You know, so we all fall in a continuum. Joseph Goldstein gave, I think, speaking of Buddhist personalities, when I was in community Dharma leadership training, he gave a talk, and it was on Buddhist personality types. And he said, you want a quick way of seeing what your personality type is? Pretend you're going to a party, and you've never been to this party. You've never been to this person's house ever in your life, but you're going. And as you go up to the house and you walk in, you are going to notice paintings and color schemes and draperies and people, and notice your response. The greedy person, there's 3 personality types, the greedy person, the aversive person, and the ignorant person. The greedy person is going to immediately go, oh, I love those paintings, and what she's wearing, that is perfect. I want that too. And all that carpet. Yes, that's for me. I'm tearing out my carpet. I'm getting that. And just wants everything. The aversive person is going to do just the opposite. When they go in, what am I doing here? I can't stand these people. Who decorated this place anyway? This is awful. It's just awful. I've got to look for a reason to get out of here. This is really miserable. And the person who is steeped in ignorance, guess what they do? What is everybody thinking about me? What's going on? Not noticing anything about who's there, what's taking place, just about what is going on with me. What does everyone think of me? So that's the ignorant person. So we're all going to have a degree of anger unless we're bodhisattvas like Xu Yun. And so the Buddha has some wonderful teachings on social and communal harmony. This is not from this book, but this is from Walpolo Rahula. Buddhism arose in India as a spiritual force against social injustices, against degrading superstitious rites, ceremonies, and sacrifices. It denounced the tyranny of the caste system and advocated the equality of all men and women. It emancipated women and gave her complete spiritual freedom. Well, that I'm not going to totally agree with, but the Buddhist scriptures do indicate the general direction of Buddhist social thinking, and to that extent, they are suggestive for our own times. And in this book, I'm getting the impression, and from other readers, maybe one of the most important aspects of anger is the ability to say no. Just to say no. Nothing more than that.
To say no to the anger?
To say no to the injustice that's taking place, just as the Buddha did in his society, ignoring the caste system, empowering women, to say no to the way things are. So this came up. I'm on the Sati board for Buddhist studies, Gil Fronsdale's group in Redwood City, and we had a board meeting last week. And the board meeting really was mostly about the current political situation, which, as Gil said, most the Dharma teachers are steering away from. You know, there's utterances, but generally nobody is saying anything very forceful. And he said, which kind of surprised me, said, "I really admire so many Christian churches that are taking a stand against injustice, against targeting people because of their nationality or their religion." He said, "I'm really in admiration of that. What do you think of that?" And that's what the discussion was about that kind of thing. And then he made a very provocative statement. He said, "I'm one of 12 people he has lay ordained as a Buddhist minister, and we're going to have another meeting in another month." And he said, "I would be very proud if any of my ministers were arrested protecting someone else." He said, "I would be very, very proud of you." I thought, wow, this is exactly what the Buddha is saying in the social and communal harmony, being willing to say no, not aggression, but being willing to say, "This stops with me. I'm not going to go along with that." This is when anger is skillful and helpful, because very often when you say no, there's a bit of anger in back of it, and it can be used skillfully as long as not in the service of your ego, but it's in the service of others, and it's in the service of ridding injustices. The Buddha has a description of those who cause anger, which I think is very interesting, and what should be done. And I'm gonna read that one, because I thought it was very, very interesting. Okay. What kind of person is to be looked upon with equanimity, not to be associated with, followed, and served? Here some person is prone to anger and easily exacerbated. Even if he is criticized slightly, he loses his temper and becomes irritated, hostile, and stubborn. He displays irritation, hatred, and bitterness, just as a festering sore, if struck by a stick or a shard, will discharge even more matter. So too, just as a firebrand of the tinduka tree, if struck by a stick or a shard, will sizzle and crackle even more, so too displays irritation, hatred, and bitterness. Such a person is to be looked upon with equanimity, but not to be associated with, followed, or served. For what reason? He might insult me, revile me, and do me harm. Therefore, such a person is to be looked upon with equanimity, not to be associated with, followed, and served. I think that's a very interesting statement. And I think that's what Gil was asking us to do. If we see injustice and somebody is not being equitable and kind, not to be followed and served. Last week, Rich talked about McMindfulness, I really appreciated. I don't think I'd heard it phrased that way before. And if we just take anger as an emotion using McMindfulness and just being mindful of anger, and that would be it. I'm mindful of my anger. Okay. This isn't what the Buddha is saying here. He's saying that we should be using this disappointment, this anger, for good, looking at what is it arising from. as I was saying, when Ajahn Amaro said, trace it back. Where is it coming from? Is it due to injustice? Where does it come from? And one guideline, we should never, ever, ever be physically violent. Ever. It is never condoned any place. The nth degree of metta, which I think many of you heard of, and Xu Yun certainly exemplified it. If we are attacked, do we just allow it to happen? That's what Xu Yun did. The Buddha even says in one of the suttas, as bandits are cutting off your legs and your arms, wish them metta.
Right.
Can you do that? Xu Yun did that. I think unless you have practiced for so long, you have developed such a mind that that is the automatic response that comes. Yeah, that's what you would do. I don't think any of us are in that place where the other is as important as us and we allow whatever happens because the ego is completely gone, the self is completely gone. But apparently it does happen, and there are people who are that selfless, who are so concerned about the well-being of others that they would let that happen. There are some teachers that even say there's wisdom, and I think Gil was saying this, there's wisdom in anger, not aggression, but there's a clarity. And our Tanka of Manjushri over there with his sword, there's a bit of anger there as he's cutting through ignorance to get to wisdom. And that's when we can use anger to our advantage. Sometimes there's a real clear clarity, tracing back what is it that's causing this, and use it for the good of ourselves and others. So there's a piece of advice the Buddha gives us. I'm paraphrasing. When the energy of anger serves ego, it is aggression. When it serves to ease other suffering and make the world a better place, it is wisdom. That's the difference. So I'm going to leave you with a thought. Gil brought this question up to our group, and I'll leave it to you. Do we as a Buddhist Sangha take action and say no when we see injustice? Is that something we should do? Or do we keep a neutral policy when we see injustice? I'm not asking for an answer, but I think it's something everybody should contemplate on, because we might have that happen right on our doorstep. It might be happening right now. And we might have to make decisions like this. This is where we live right now. And that's the end of my talk. So if you have any comments or concerns or rebuttals to what I said or your own experience, would love to hear them.
I'm struggling to synthesize everything that I've heard and believe about anger. And I'm familiar with some quotes from the Buddha that says, if, you know, someone who's angry is like someone who swallows a ball of fire and it just burns them. It doesn't, you know, hurt the person they're angry with. And at the same time, I feel... Mm-hmm. It's unhealthy to deny it or suppress it. So, and it seems to me like what you're suggesting, which is something I completely agree with, that anger isn't bad or good in itself, that it can serve as a pointer to something deeper, a hurt or a need that needs to be addressed, and that can be addressed socially. But it's not okay to be angry, and it's not bad to be angry. But acting out of anger, out of control, harsh speech, you know, wrong speech, you know, harming people, that can all happen if someone's acting with this discord.
That's right.
So it's not so much, I see it as not so much the anger that is good in some instances, it's just how it's used. And I don't know if that's what you're saying or if you agree with that. And one very poignant example that always sticks in my mind is this story about a samurai. I'd heard Joseph Campbell tell it, that it was his job to go and kill the enemy of his lord. And he had tracked this guy down very methodically, and he was going to do his job. And then right when he got to the guy spit in his face, and he turned around and walked away because he wasn't going to kill someone in anger. He was going to kill him, but not after the guy spit in his face. He was calm down. He didn't want to have any bad karma, I guess. So, I don't know. Does my understanding, is that what you're saying, or is that different from what you're saying?
I think this is a difficult topic, and I'm bringing it up because the questions you raise, I think, are appropriate and something that we need to think about. The Buddha said we don't suppress anger and we don't act it out. The middle way is with patience, with mindfulness, and metta as the antidote. That's how we work with it. But it also states anger in its clear form, without the ego attached, can be very helpful in seeing what needs to be done in a larger perspective.
I think maybe it's the same as what he said, but the difficulty with anger is the almost instant identification with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it's become my anger, I become it.
Right.
I'm attacked from it. And that, I think, is the difficulty, is losing sight when it's energy, then you can step back and say, oh, that's anger arising. And it's hard to do.
That's why we're practicing.
That's why we're practicing.
That's exactly right. You're right. Yeah, Brian.
I appreciate your teaching on the anger. I got kind of offended, or still stay offended, and I hope, since so many board members are here tonight, that they would really think twice about making this a political sanctuary. And I get concerned when a teacher's promoting people going to jail. That has many, many consequences. And I can just see from the people I associate with, you say, boy, you get brownie points if you go to jail and some loose cannon goes and does something violent as a reaction to somebody else. And I consider this a sanctuary for the Dharma, for my sanctuary from the chaos of Channel 3 News. And I hope this doesn't become another hour-filled political stage for political views. I hope all that shit stays out of the Dharma Hall when we talk about anger and that, not about marching on whoever or overthrowing whoever. So I hope the board really listens to what they bring into the Dharma Hall.
Thank you. Yes.
Maybe this is obvious to everybody else and I'm just missing it, but from the talk I kind of saw this beginning. The beginning point and then the destination. The beginning point is the convict in the yard where he's going in and he has to deal with that conflict every day. And then the end point is becoming like the line drawn in water where you don't react to anything. How do you get from that point to the end point? Just you know, quite easy if you don't mind it.
Another Dharma talk, huh? I think the line in the water, the Buddha was talking about three personalities. And he was talking about people who maintain anger, etched in the stone, people who have some anger, let it go. And then people, anger just disappears almost immediately. You know, it just doesn't take place hardly at all when it's a line in the water. the inmate was definitely working with etched in the stone and trying to make it etched in the ground. And he managed to do that because he walked away. If it had been etched in stone, he would have stayed there and continued escalating as he had done in the past. And this person had been thrown into solitary confinement due to his anger issues. Yeah.
Well, it's like, I guess, for me, I'm in a situation where I constantly get into conflict with certain people.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reasons, I say, okay, I'm walking away. I come back, and then I get pressured to go back into that. Thinking, okay, it's not happening. Well, guess what happens to me? And it's been going on. And, I go through it, I process the anger from the first situation. Like, okay, well, I think I understand what happened, and go back into it, and it just continues. And I just feel like, meditation, I do pretty good meditation in groups, but I can't really do it on my own because I'm usually so pissed off most of the time. is meditation how we're supposed to get from point A to point B, or is walking away just doesn't seem to really help that much? It just makes me more
pissed. Have you taken a beginning meditation course?
Not a whole course, no.
Well, it's still open. I think you should consider doing that because, this is part of it. How to deal with emotions is one component of it. Anger is just one emotion. Lots of emotions come up, and slowing them down. This is the pause that I spoke about, learning how to pause and not respond immediately, learning to be mindful of them, investigating it, is all part of learning meditation and learning to deal with real life issues. I encourage you to do that. Yeah, Judy.
I'm trying to make sense out of, my own feelings. And Brian, you brought up very adamantly that the Sangha should not be involved in justice issues. It should remain what? A place of security or safety or
sanctuary.
Yeah. But my feeling about anger is it's almost necessary in order to make changes that are to bring back justice in a situation. Community organizers use that anger as a way to get people together, get water in their community, to have safe crosswalks for their kids. It comes from their anger over the government, that city government, not paying attention. So it's hard to reconcile, what you're saying with, and I think part of it is being a social worker as well, that we, there's much, you see things a little differently, I think, because of the way you work with people. Maybe that's not so, but that's my feeling. So it's then if you have a belief that is not in line with, mm-hmm. What does that mean?
This is why I brought it up. This is exactly it, and I think this is something that we each have to think about. Exactly what happens when injustice takes place? Do we all feel injustice is the same thing, even? Can we even define it? But this is where the world is now,
right?
And it's something I don't think anybody just walked away from. I think you really have to consider it, meditate with it, what needs to be done, and have a discussion about it. Yeah, Boogie.
I feel like sharing my immediate response mm-hmm. to that, what comes into my mind is, it's not something I've really thought about, but it just strikes me that what you're describing, a reaction to injustice, is for individual members to do. I just feel like the group is best served by disseminating the teachings of the Buddha, and then how to apply that. To me, that seems none of us own that. None of us own how to interpret, mm-hmm. how to apply that. I feel that instead that's for each of us to decide for ourselves. And the other thing too is personally, I think that's a great way to end up just preaching to the choir. Mm-hmm. It seems to me like if the group were to take stand on political issues or something like that, because to me, for example, like I said, disseminating the teachings, well, do you just want to disseminate them to people who kind of are already in the same? For example, somebody who, you know, would maybe disagree with the stance that the larger group would take.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, that's somebody that I would like to hear, to be hearing the Dharma personally. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think they would be turned off, and it wouldn't be a sanctuary for them, and they wouldn't come.
But remember, I never said use the word politics. Talked about injustice, and when Gil was talking, he was talking about people who are suffering due to injustice. And he was citing specific examples in his Sangha of people who will be forced to leave the country. So it was not politics, mm-hmm. it was suffering. And do we stand by? And that's what I'm opening up here. I don't want to go into politics, any of that, but injustice and the suffering of sentient beings.
But hasn't social injustice been the American way for the last 1,000 years?
Absolutely. I've got
everybody but the white man has been socially unjust.
Mm-hmm.
So Native Americans, blacks, Hispanics, so why today?
Margaret?
I want to go back to the pugilistic monk,
mm-hmm.
And the idea that there are personalities. I mean, we do all have personalities, and it seems to me our individual practices then end up having to deal with those things that are intrinsic to our personality that get in the way of moving beyond suffering. So. Because I was thinking, didn't he know that he was? And what happened to right speech? I mean, and sort of in answer to what you, one of the differences between mindfulness and Buddhist meditation, I believe, is that we are also within that framework of right speech, right? The Eightfold Path,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't dictate, it gives you the framework to wrestle with. It. So, for me, right speech when I'm angry is a huge issue, and I go straight in my head to, okay, is it timely? Is it kind? So those are our tools, and that's equally important for supporting the understanding your anger is one thing, but the tools for having you direct yourself, and then through cultivating that, you find yourself having less of that immediate that anger doesn't manifest so much because it becomes more automatic to take that pause and to. But that framework to me is everything, and regardless of personality, and we all probably have in our personalities the different things that need to be wrestled with within that whole path.
Thank you. One more, and it is 9:05. Yeah, Ma.
How long and how much injustice would we be willing to tolerate as a group, as a sangha, before we take action? I'm reminded of for evil to exist, it is only necessary for good men to do nothing. What's the cutoff where we preach to each other and allow
mm-hmm.
injustice to take place on our doorstep?
These are all really good thoughts that everybody has given, and yes.
So,
I think that, that American Sangha is a historic moment. And, you know, if you look back to the original Sangha, you know, the original Sangha wasn't demonstrating in the streets or doing boycotts. They created, they came together and folded in and created their own community based on a series of principles of non-harming and internal justice. And that pulling in and isolating themselves and to some degree isolating themselves from the larger community around them is clearly one of the elements that led to the Mahayana movement, because people began to feel that the monastic order was no longer relevant or as relevant as it should be in terms of helping the community. And then, you know, we moved into that. And so I think we're about to bump up to that.
Yep.
Against that here, right? It's absolutely unavoidable. When I was in my training at Spirit Rock, it was right after 9/11. And we had our, one of the training retreats 3 days after all the buildings had been down in New York. And so there's a lot of discussion about this. And one afternoon, half of the Sangha made signs and marched down to whatever the main road is there and demonstrated. And the rest of the Sangha, who wasn't supporting that particular form, remained up in the Dharma Hall and did work and meditated. And then everybody came back together into the same community and were a harmonious community. So I think we're going to have to find ways to be creative for people actually to survive some of the trauma that's going on right now. You know, I think people are experiencing, I know I am experiencing a lot of secondary trauma. You know, I don't have a member of my family being deported or, you know, held at airports or anything else, but I have friends of people that I care about that are having that, and I'm seeing that it's happening. And just a myriad of things. So I think as a community, this will be something that will be important to discuss. You know, what we do with it is a completely different thing, but I think we actually get this up on the table and look at it and not avoid it and not just have a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, boy, we can't bring that into the Dharma Hall. And personally, I don't like this room being called a sanctuary because I think it's a Dharma Hall. You know, in our tradition, we've always referred to the hall as a Dharma Hall. And a Dharma Hall has a much bigger and more engaged meaning, at least for me, than the term sanctuary. And if, you know, we just allow ourselves to act as if the external world doesn't exist, and when we get together, we just develop a particular set of common abiding principles, I question whether that supports us once we walk out the door. And I'm interested in figuring that out. How do we bring everybody in together in a way that everybody can feel comfortable and not threatened, and that what we do here actually supports us once we walk out the door?
I thank you for that, and that's exactly why I wanted to bring this out. I really want to start the conversation.
Thank you very much.
And people think about it. Pardon me?
I'm going to follow it up next week.
And I don't think any of us have a definitive answer. They're all over the place, but we have to start considering because, yeah, as Dennis said, this is coming closer, and it's not going to be some kind of nebulous thing that's happening out there. It's going to be happening to people we know and maybe to ourselves.
I'm new. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be disrespectful. Sometimes I think about big things and then little things. And there was a gentleman here last week, you may be here this week, who talked about what he took from the talk that was given of being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And how big our world is or not. And I know sometimes we can get actually distracted by the large world and miss the chances of just being present in the moment. On the other hand, I like to sometimes think, what's going on in the big world that we struggle with, and can we be separate from it? And as an example, and I don't have to answer the question in this manner, so I'm not here to judge, but the world right now is struggling with diversity, amongst other things. Can a sangha, I'm not sure I appreciate what that word means, Lord, not hold diversity and be alive? And I don't know.
I think none of us have a definitive answer, but we do need to start thinking about, you know, what are we as a group? What are we, as you said, as individuals? What kind of stand are we taking in our own lives? What's important to us? What do we have to cultivate? So it is 9:12. Sorry. So just a nope. Sit down. Quick metta. So get in a comfortable position. So just take a second. And may our discussion here, may our contemplation of how we are in the world, how we affect the world, may this be of benefit to all living beings. May wisdom and compassion come out of our discussions, either alone in our meditation or in groups. And may we respect and honor each other. May there be peace, and may every one of us in this room know complete freedom, and hopefully in this lifetime. So thank you all for coming.